I'm Gennarty O'Sullivan, and I'm a radio broadcaster. I've been working out of Co-op Radio as a volunteer for the last 20 years plus. I've lost track of myself. And I've also worked at CJSF, which is SFU Campus Radio Station, and CITR. And how did I get here? Well, it was a really interesting story. Around, I think it was 2006 or 2007, I got re-engaged with Co-op Radio, and they asked me if I would like to go to the National Community Radio Association Conference, and I said, yes, I would love to do that. And I did, and it was in Montreal, and when I got there, the place was just buzzing because there were like 80 radio broadcasters from across the country in this one place at the same time. It was so incredible and inspiring and frightening because I didn't know anybody there. I was just getting back into the game myself, and I felt insecure. I felt inadequate. And it took a few people to just kind of take me and put me under their wings, like this fellow right here, and Gretchen, and even this little girl, even though she doesn't know it, she took me and lifted me up. And the National Community Radio Association also did the same thing. At the time, Catherine Fisher was the president, and there was a lack of representation on the board and even at from station to station across the country. And I remember Laith getting up at one point and speaking on our behalf, fighting for a right to have a presence at the conference and from station to station, and that we needed a voice and the NCRA needed to take a responsibility. And then I said yes. I have a mixed back upbringing. I was brought up by non-Native people, but I also have embraced my language and culture, so sometimes I'm kind of in the middle. And this one occasion, I stood up, and even though Laith was speaking on our behalf, I also felt it was important to say that it's also our responsibility as First Nations people. The NCRA can take it so far, right? We got to meet them in the middle. And we have to be willing to do the work that it's going to take to have our voices be heard. And it isn't easy. Sometimes it just gets left up to one person to hold down a show or hold down a fort, which is what I've been doing for 20 years. People, they come and they go, and they come and they go as they choose. But if there's not somebody there holding down the fort, what isn't being used is lost, just like the land and all of the resources that we are currently losing. And the reason it's important to have a presence in media is really obvious to me right now. We're all so displaced. I come from I'm one of those people who has been through the full nine yards. I was born into a family of dysfunction because of the residential school, abandoned. Then I was fostered out. Then I was put in a residential school. And then I was adopted out. That's just one person. Now we have so many people that have been displaced through the foster care system, the adoption process, and orphanages and jails and all of these things, right? So if you think about it, here we are in the midst of land negotiations, talking about lands of expressions of interest and things we don't even, that's way over our head to begin with. But if we're all displaced and we don't know where we come from, then how does this play out in this current process that we're going through with the independent assessment process? You know, and the Kinder Morgan pipelines and all of the resource extraction that's going on without our consultation, because we don't even know where we belong in this whole picture anymore. People who have been adopted and lost to the system and then continue to lose their children, continue to have to fight for their children, and all at the same time try to keep up with what is happening with our lands, rights, and title. It just seems impossible, and that's why media And community and campus radio stations are so important, and it doesn't surprise me that you have had so much trouble kicking down the doors, even at a community level. That's disgraceful, right? And the campus level, we're all volunteers here, and they won't even allow us to have a voice for free. I remember trying to do a radio documentary with one of those stations, the station, and hearing how they treated one of our First Nations residential school victims was atrocious. She was a handicapped woman, had gone to work with a station, and it's supposed to be a community and campus radio station, and because the material she was dealing with was rather controversial, and they weren't sure if they wanted to do it or not in the end. They pulled out at the last minute, and they left these two residential school survivors just hanging, and we had to actually find them. Your station, right? We hooked you up with CJ Rice. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and I think it's going to take a lot of people to pull this together and to keep it together, and creating the awareness between First Nations people and others that have settled here in Canada, and that there has to be some kind of transparency in and around the land negotiations that are going on right now. And, you know, I also think that the associations like the National Community Radio Association do have a responsibility to create policies and procedures that will protect the interests of First Nations people, right? From region to region. Because I went to the conferences, I was invited to sit on the board at a national level, which is what I did. And with that, we created funding to do a project from nation to nation across the country. We engaged 40 radio stations to do 40 radio documentaries on residential school survivors and intergenerational survivors. And with that, we were able to train a producer, say 40 producers across the country on how to do the technical aspects of radio, how to host, how to interview, and how to be sensitive. And so it's not like there are not people out there who are willing to work with each station and who have worked on building that relationship. So it's all about building relationships, and simulcasts are really great because you get to get extra mileage. Gretchen was really famous for holding the homelessness marathons, 24-hour marathon from region to region. Sometimes there would be 20 radio stations listening to the same content. And so every year I hold a because I sat in and contributed to the homelessness marathon, I got the idea to hold a Red Jam Slam once a year in Vancouver. And at these Red Jam Slams, I invite, say, 30 or 40 artists for 5 days, 5 hours a week, and we just jam on the air. And CITR provides us with a live remote, and then we go from Halifax to Vancouver, Edmonton, Saskatchewan, all over the place, and they carry this feed. And so what that does is it gives each participant, like, 14,000 listeners at one time. And I think that it would be really great if radio stations could go to these BC Chief Summit meetings, hook up a remote there, right? And let's hear exactly what's going on with the land negotiations and treaties. You know, they need to be held accountable. They're making some serious decisions here. They're buying land. We are buying land here in BC. And we're selling it back to the government so that we can stay on welfare. That's what's happening in BC. We're getting money from, we're buying land from Timber West. It's never ending, and we can't catch up to it. So live stream, podcasts, is really really important right now, and doing it by any means necessary is even important. Don't wait for the money, don't wait for the funding. We don't have time. No time whatsoever. We have so much time to make up for. You have to find creative ways, like these simulcasts. Facebook has live streaming on it. We could be live streaming this right now. Right now. And all of our friends would see it. I have 2,000 friends. How many friends do you have? And so we share it, and next thing you know, we get the mileage that we need out of everything we do. Everything. It's just the only way we can swing right now. We don't have any more time. I know I don't, and we're all running out of energy, right? And everybody has to do their part. And I'm not saying, okay, I'm going to go and I'm going to cook you dinner. I'm not a good cook. But I could come and I could provide you with a live stream, and I can do interviews, and I can pull out my camera, and I can put it on Facebook right away and send it out to social media, right? Somebody else might come to the table with some funding to help us get through the day. It took like 10 people just to get me here today, right? It takes the village to do anything. So, that's how I feel.
And so when we finally hooked up and I called her, Audrey was near me, and I handed her the phone, and she did a radio interview from the Women's March with Audrey, and I thought, this is brilliant.
You have to keep things on the fly. Yeah. You know, I get some of my best interviews on the fly. The other day,
with it, because they were the papers were specific about what was required for us to be able to get the distribution. There was one that gave us money for losing our language, and that was about it. But the next paper was the abuse from the residential school. And I asked, you know, why is it just abuse? You know, like I said, there was psychological abuse for me, but I wasn't raped or anything in school. And I said, where I was raped was on the reserve. Is there going to be a question on that? Because I'm pretty sure a lot of women, when the guys that were molested and all that from the residential school, they came home and they started molesting the women, the children and that. And that's what happened to me, you know. Somebody came home and did that to me. And I said, isn't there going to be a question on that, you know, about us being molested on reserve? A lot of us, I knew a lot of children that had been molested from a guy that came home from residential school and I was only 6 years old. And then I heard later on he was doing the same to other children. And who put these papers together anyway? I said, you know, to make it out as it was, you know, that it had to happen in residential school. And I didn't get an answer until he was talking about it, that he said it was not, and I thought it was the Grand Chiefs, you know, that were across Canada, but he said it was the government who decided on it. And I thought, no wonder why, you know, that it was so strict about how we were supposed to fill those papers out. And I filled one out to say I had psychological abuse, you know, not only from what happened to me, but, you know, the verbal and punishments and all that that I had in residential school, and I call it psychological abuse. And when I talked to a lawyer about it, he said, oh, no, that would cost more money. That would cost the government more money in order to cover that, you know, that part of it. About. And I'm pretty sure probably hundreds of women were raped on reserve when the guys came home from being raped in school. And they didn't want to even listen to that or cover that, you know. And I was really angry, you know, about it, because I didn't get... It was not the idea of getting money, but not being heard, you know. I don't know if anybody ever felt invisible, but I felt like I was really invisible. Nobody was listening to me. Nobody heard anything I had to say. And that really made me, you know, very upset for many years. And then this happened again with the money that they were giving us, you know, for upgrading, $3,000. Again, I didn't get that because we didn't do the papers right. And they held that back. And I wanted to learn, you know, technology and computers and stuff. And I couldn't get that money. And I was really upset about that because when I phoned somebody about it, that woman said, well, get you a lawyer to find out what to do about it. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm on pension. How am I supposed to be able to afford a lawyer, you know? I was more upset than I said, oh, forget it. You know, you guys way up there that have all the power, have all the say. You don't hear anything I have to say. Any complaints I have, you just don't hear it. I was just ready to give up on this whole thing, you know, because like all of you I've been hearing, who makes all the decisions? They do. The people that have the power of say are the ones who make all the decisions. It's almost like we don't have a voice. They won't hear anything we say. I watch APTN a lot, and it's not just us. It's all those Native people, even across Canada, that are getting ripped off left and right all over the place, you know, right? So it's not just us. We're getting ripped off, and every time we turn around, they're ripping us off on something, the government, you know? And I was saying they should fire those people that make all those rules, like INAC. And that was my criticism about the whole thing, eh? The government people make all these decisions for us, you know? How come we don't have a voice to say what we would like to see happening, you know? And it's just like a hopeless cause, you know? And sometimes I felt like just saying, forget it. I don't want to be involved in any of it. I'm tired of it. I've done a lot of, that's the reason why I said I was an activist, because I did do a lot of things like putting out petitions on the reserve. That was another disappointment. I would put a petition out and I guess chief and council would just throw it in the garbage. There'd be no response either for that. Yeah. You know, it's not only them, but I don't know, maybe the band office people have learned something from the government, not to listen to us either, you know, on the reserves. And that's been a real big disappointment for me, you know, to try to make the change, to make our community more healthier, you know, to let us have a voice and to ask for what we feel we need. You know, it was the AGM meeting. I put a petition out. We haven't had an AGM meeting for the last 6 years. Who decided not to give us one? You know, we don't know what kind of money comes through. Those kind of things are going on, even here. And what do we do about it? They tie our hands and can't seem to move in any direction to do something, you know, so.
And in an ordinary world, that would be news.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It would be news and it would be breaking news. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's a problem. And I just wanted to talk to you about the residential school agreement. I agree with the process was a shoddy process. And it reoffended us over and over again, especially the independent assessment process. And the problem with the agreement was that the band chiefs and councils were not engaged in that agreement. Otherwise, they would have taken care of our best interests. The independent assessment process wouldn't have even made it to print. And so now we have this thing called the 60 Scoop litigation that's going on in British Columbia right now. Does anybody know about that? Probably not.
And to make it even more dangerous is that the chiefs and councils don't even really know about the 60 Scoop litigation that's going on in here in BC. And if we don't get them engaged in the making of that agreement, then it will end up just like the Truth and Reconciliation or the Residential School Agreement. So, and that's why it's really important to get the band and council involved, you know.
They don't explain it to us, and it's like we're way out, maybe in the middle of nowhere. Sometimes I feel that way, because the Truth and Reconciliation hasn't really come here to our reserve, at least I don't think so. You know, what was supposed to be involved in that, I don't hear much of anything about it.
There's 94 recommendations that came out of the Truth and Reconciliation Agreement, and hardly anybody knows what they are either. I even don't. But there is a group of people in Vancouver who are putting together an Artist Against Pipeline Day on July 1st, and they're going to be doing a reading of the Truth and Reconciliation recommendations, and they're going to do this within a 24-hour period, and I'm trying to rally them to let me do a live remote of the event so that we can go nation to nation, but they're a little bit scared and going, oh, I don't know if we can do it. I'm like, no, yeah, we can do it. Don't worry, let's do it. We'll just see what happens. So, but if it does happen, I'll let you know, and you could read it. I think that reconciliation right now is being an overused word, in that they're using it to move, the government is using it to move forward their agendas with the pipelines. If you remember Justin Trudeau's response after he approved the pipeline, the first words out of his mouth were, reconciliation means that you're not always going to agree with the decisions made. That's what reconciliation is to him. But it's really up to you what reconciliation is to you. To me, reconciliation was me reaching back to my ancestors, to my mom, and saying, I forgive you, and I love you, and I miss you, and I wish you were here, right? Reconciliation for me means that I am going to ensure that my daughters don't have to go through the same things that I've been through. And I'll do everything in my power to protect them from the atrocities that I've had to live through so that things will be easier for them. You know?
I used to be a support worker, and they would fly me there to attend those meetings. Bobby Joseph, I guess, was behind that. And they said that they were going to record all the people that had been in residential school, put it in some place and make a plaque of it, and to make sure that people knew who went to residential school from families, just so that it would never happen again. You know, people would make sure it stays alive, because people will forget that there was ever a residential school, to show that our ancestors and all of them had been to residential school. And they would make sure that that was put into some place where it would never be, you know, forgotten, I guess was the word they used. I didn't see it happen. That was the first plan I heard anyway, for Truth and Reconciliation. Kind of lost even an idea of what you're supposed to be, you know? I think that our people are really discouraged. You know, every time they say they're going to do something for us, it falls through. You know what I mean? It's a discouraging kind of pattern that's happened, not only for our community, but maybe everywhere else. I don't know. But they, you know, they say they're going to do something for us, and then we don't, it falls through the cracks or something. Like the idea of CCP coming in here, and we were supposed to have a community plan development, and all of a sudden it fell by the wayside. It's not happening, you know.
That's convenient.
Yeah, you know, things like that, given us hope. I had high hopes that we would have our community better, in a better place, but it didn't happen either.
And they always say it won't happen in your lifetime, but it will happen in your children's lifetime. And
yeah.
We have to make sure that they're not saying that to our children.
Mm-hmm.
That, listen, you know, this land negotiated multiple wealth won't happen in your lifetime. Your children will benefit from it.
We've been hearing that for far too long, and I think a part of it is our responsibility too, and that sometimes we get set up for the big fall and failure, and the problem that we have such a hard time, even though we can get together like this sometimes, can we really keep it together when we come from such varied backgrounds, like a traditional upbringing, somebody who was brought up with their mom and their dad, compared to somebody that was brought up in foster home who went from one place to another, had 10 or 20 different moms and dads, brothers and sisters, schools and friends and family and all of that. And then you have those people who are adopted who feel like they're more privileged than everybody else because they were adopted and life is better for them and thank God they were adopted. And then you have the people that were in residential schools who were traumatized over and over for 7 years and felt abandoned, right? And so when we finally do get together, it's really hard for us to keep it together and get anything done because we have a varied background and upbringings and ideas and values.
He was adopted out. They just went ahead and adopted him out on me. Yeah, and I never saw him again until I looked for him through that program that I was talking to him about. They had a person there that looked for people that were adopted out, and that person tracked my son down in the States, and I finally got together again with him. And he was 28 years old by then, you know? So I lost all those years. Because, you know, they had adopted him out, and they say once your child is adopted out, the ministry will not ever fill you in on where he is or who adopted him. So you never know. So when I found out UNN had an adoption type of a program, I went through them twice. I did that. I found my son, and the other one was my daughter's. She's passed away now, but she had a little baby. They adopted that little girl, and we were looking for each other. She was trying to find out where her mother was, but they tracked me down. She tracked me down, and we got together. Now, you know, she's within our family. So is my son. But, I mean, those kind of things have been happening through the system. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So years ago, and I was just texting trying to find out what year that was, seems to me it was around 2002 or something like that. You know, Arthur was traveled all over the place. I told a little bit of this last night. He traveled all over the place, and he met up with some dude down in California who, and he was mentioning to him, you know, these concerns about our ability to capture our share of the media industry. And so the guy had a transmitter and all the stuff to start up a radio station. So he just said, I'll come up there and I'll train your people and I'll put it up wherever you want it. So he put it up at his house, which was right next door to my house. And a lot of people were curious and just wandered over, and they got trained. And his son was one of the people, Ineski. Ineski was brilliant. He had just a brilliant mind for science and communications, and he could wrap his mind around that so easily. So of the ones that were trained, they just started, you know, we're our family and a lot of the people we hang out in our community, we're not like concerned about money because we know it wrecks things. So nobody cared they were getting paid, and they just came and volunteered. And Ineski was brilliant at setting up a schedule and figuring out, you know, how to put this whole thing together. And in my travels, I collected music and gave him my CDs, and he'd upload them. And it didn't matter, like, you just go over and visit Arthur or something, and the next thing you know, you were sitting down in that room getting interviewed.
Yeah.
Interview you over anything and everything. And it wasn't just him, it was all these other people. And he had Blair Sampson, who was really involved and interested. Well, now Blair and Ineski have both passed on. So sometimes it would go down for a while, as, you know, growing pains, and then they'd figure out, okay, well, how can we fix this problem? Or sometimes the equipment would go down for a little while and he'd be, you know, messaging with the guy who set it up initially. Well, when Nesky passed away, it went down, and it's been down ever since, so 2011. And now they finally cleaned out that room again and contacted this guy, and he's going to come back up soon, and he's going to reset it all up again and train some more people. And now he's talking about training us in another way where that I could even be a host from Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And be on the computer and do it. Mm-hmm. So once it's set up like that, I think it'll be a little bit easier again. Because, I mean, just even coming to talk about this, Kanahus and I were like sitting in my van brainstorming, well, who's still alive that knows the history of the radio station who can go up there and talk about it? And we just couldn't come up with anybody. And so, you know, between her and I, and she couldn't make it to this event, so I wound up coming. So we're kind of brand new all over again. The whole thing was never with a license. It was just totally free, totally pirate. And that's the way we roll. Like, we don't want to have to go apply for stuff. And it's, so one of our things is we only had a short range. Halfway to Kamloops or halfway to Salmon Arm, you'd lose us. So if it was in the middle of a story and I was listening to it, I'd just stop on the side of the highway and finish listening to the story. But there was people in town, like non-Aboriginals, starting to listen to it and comment when you went around town. Because it was different music. You know, it was Indigenous music from around the world. And so it was more alive and more interesting. And then these interviews about all of the current events, but from an Aboriginal perspective. And people were interested in that. So other than that, I'm not really sure what else to say about it.
Well, I met Nesky at the National Community Radio Association, and he was just like a mover and a shaker, and people were always crowded around him. Everywhere he went, you could hear people calling, Nesky, Nesky, 1 minute, Nesky, just a second here, I got a quick question for you. And he would answer them like this. You have this huge smile on his face all the time. I remember looking at him thinking, I want to be like Nesky, like, yeah, just like him. And I was just so impressed with how self-motivated he was and how he inspired other people in the community and just his willingness. He just went nonstop. So I can imagine it's like taking 10 steps backwards when you lose somebody like that in the community. And all of the archives that go with the work and the interviews that he's done too. Yeah. He came from a strong background, which kind of leads me to what the future of radio is and how I feel that's going to go is, like you just heard Doreen talk about Nesky Manuel. This is somebody who's, I guess, is great-grandfather was George Manuel, Arthur Manuel is his father, Kanahus Manuel is his sister, right? Vera Manuel was his auntie, who is a script writer and a theatrical actor, and then you have somebody here who's working in film and television. So those kind of people are going to be the future of Indigenous radio, which is a different to somebody like me, who has had to not only learn again how to be Native, how to be comfortable in my own skin, how to learn why it is that I am like I am, why my mom was like how she was, and how the rest of my family is the way that they are. We have people that have been brought up and have a strong upbringing. And that will make the difference to the future of radio. Not only do they have this strong upbringing, consistency and stability and security, right? But they have all of this technical training and skills and abilities. And then they've built all of these relationships over the years. It's going to be 10 times easier for them. We'll have networks going. And I think that one of the things that we need to look at from a First Nations perspective is that we have to grow with technology. And right now we're just getting back into the role of our ceremonies, and we're being very protective of it. And we have these things called protocol and appropriation, which is basically stunting our growth. And I know that they're there for a reason, but right now it's being counterproductive. And if we don't open the airwaves to some of these ceremonies that are going on, even if these are closed ceremonies, how are we going to learn it if we don't hear it or see it? How are we going to get back into the swing of our ceremonies if we don't make it like pop culture, right? And exciting and inspiring. So when there is a naming ceremony, why can't we celebrate that? Why can't we bring in that camera and that recorder and put it on the air? If a ceremony takes 4 hours, then you secure a 4-hour time slot to cover the full ceremony. Why can't we cover marriage ceremonies and memorial potlatches and the sun dance and all of these things? And we should be. We need to be. It's our responsibility as people who work in the media, I think, to do that, to again play that part. What do you think?
I think some ceremonies. I like the naming. I think that that's probably okay. But there are, like, when you say ceremony, I think about the spiritual ceremonies.
Yeah.
And, like, we have a ceremony in the Kootenays. It's called the jump dance. And nobody except Kootenays are allowed in there, or unless they're married in. And it's been alive since the beginning of time. And when contact came, it just went and hid in the mountains for a while, and it's come back down. And you go there, and elders and little children are for 3 days straight praying and dancing, 3 days, 3 nights, all night long. And man, you go in there and you've lived in the white world, like the first time I went back. And it was just like, I can't believe this exists. Oh my God. And now my kids, you know, they've grown up there and they talk about it, and they couldn't not go any more than they could not breathe. I think they would just fall over and collapse if we didn't go there every New Year's. And those kind of ceremonies, like, there is a reason to keep those secret and private, because I think if that was opened up, all kinds of people would be there, and I think it would lose some of its power. And sweat lodges, I think that needs to be private. And
because it's
dances.
A little hard to pull in a camera into a
sweat
lodge. Yeah. The lens will get all lens.
I think it's dangerous too.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a friend just died of a heart attack at a sweat lodge. And I think it was because of breaking protocols. People have died at sun dances. You don't mess with those things.
Yeah.
You know? And then even moving human remains back home, we don't let them move it. You want that highway to go through there? Put the highway over there then. You know, we'll fight it. We fought it. Because you mess with that, people die. It's sacred.
Yeah. Okay.
So sacred ceremonies, I think we can talk about it. Mm-hmm. We can describe it. You know, I went on a fast. I made a movie called The Fast. And I was on a 4-day fast, and I brought a little camera crew. And I wasn't sure if the spirits would show up because I brought the camera. But they did show up on the third day. But when they showed up, we did not film it. Instead, when I was in edit, I described it and I found images that could try to help people feel what I was explaining. And I edited that. And people who see it, they say they can feel it. Yeah. You find creative ways.
Yeah. That's good. See what I mean? Like how an adopted person and you and I come with different ideas, mm-hmm. but we come to an understanding, like, just by having that conversation, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it takes time, and a lot of people don't have time either.
Yeah. What I love about how Ganarji works, she's always inviting people in, like, to train them. Mm-hmm. And she's got, like, the radio program. She's on Access TV. She's got all this connection in the community, and she invites all these really interesting guests in. She's strong-armed me to co-host with her.
Yeah. I throw them to the wolves.
Yeah. I'm always on my Facebook, and I'm like, oh, she wants me to call again. Oh, now what am I going to say?
No.
But I love it. I love that you're that connected to the community, and everybody knows who you are. You are like Nesky.
I'm like my adopted mom, actually. This is my adopted cousin. I don't usually say that. This is Stephen. He's my cousin. And that's his wife, Sandy. And they live in the area, so I invited them to come sit in with us. So you get to meet my family here.
I have a question on language. We had bibles
that, because it was coming from Slam, and then maybe you answered.
Yes, so we have a 5-year agreement with UVic and UBC to be producing an online e-dictionary. The linguist tells us we need 20,000 words and phrases to save our language, and we're about a year in now, and we have just over 4,000, but that's separate from what's already online on First Voices. So it's still an ongoing process. We try and meet about once a month.
Okay. Well, that's good. I thought it had died out or something.
Yeah, we almost have our prototype available for the online dictionary.
Okay.
So we're still working everything out.
Glad it's still alive.
Can I ask a question? How many languages do you have in British Columbia? Like, are these different dialects of a base language, or are they like different languages altogether?
No, in British Columbia, there's 37 Indigenous languages, and of those 37, there's about 67 different dialects. Oh. So we're so diverse here just because of the geography.
Is that right? That's amazing. Because if you look at Ontario, where we have the largest population, but I think we have 9 languages. You know, mainly the north is Ojibwe, Oji Cree, and Cree. And then as you move further south, you hit into the Iroquois, Odawa, Potawatomi, Ojibwe, what's the other one? Mohawk. So it's like, you guys have 63 languages? No, well, sorry, 37 languages, 63 dialects. Wow. That's huge.
It's a lot of radio stations to set up.
In our first treaty meeting, Chief and Council gave us books with our language and family photos in there. And I think we got like 2 or 3 different books. And it's actually, you could write in it even.
It's actually, they have them in the office there.
There's
some. And I found the discs, the language discs, in the closet there.
There's one actually right on the stage behind.
And I just, I think actually we're making a really nice bridge here. I'd like to move into the language portion, and then I think maybe do we need just a little break after we talk about language, and then we can set up for CITR and then continue the conversation. Does that sound amenable?